KCAA and KCAA Internet Television, the station that leaves no listener and no viewer behind.
Is over, and President Obama has a second term as the President of the United States. I think on Fox News it actually wasn't anticipated, but all the other news outlets actually did anticipate it. But instead of focusing on what's going on right now in Gaza, which is being paid for with American tax dollars. I'm back on. Thank you. What I was saying, instead of focusing on what's going on right now in the Middle East, Gaza is under attack, and that's being paid for with American tax dollars, is resignation due to a extramarital affair. And after reading my guest's book, his book is Divert, my guest's name is Grant Smith, after reading his book, I have come to the conclusion that the biggest scandal and threat to national security isn't General Petraeus, but the spying and persistent and consistent stealing of American nuclear materials and information and military equipment by Israel. All this information, all the details, can be found in my guest book, Grant Smith. I'm delighted to have him as a guest today. So the question on the table is, why doesn't the mainstream media in the United States follow the lead of Grant Smith? That's the question on the table. Before I bring on my guest, I want to give out the call-out number, or rather call-in number, so my listeners can call in with questions for Mr. Smith. So that number is 1-888-909-1050. That's a toll-free number. Please call in. We're going to examine thoroughly what's going on right now in Gaza. Well, no, we're not going to examine what's going on right now in Gaza. What we're going to examine is, why was Israel able to get away with stealing nuclear materials from the United States, and why was that covered up? Why weren't the American people aware that this was going on? Today, actually, in Israel, there's an attack going on against Gaza. Israel has rejected a truce with Hamas and escalated fighting in Gaza with the assassination of the Hamas leader. 10 have been killed and 45 wounded in Israeli attacks. The Institute for Middle East Understanding has collected quotes from on the ground in Gaza. Quote, around 4 p.m., I was at home in Gaza City and I heard a loud explosion. It later became clear that it was an assassination, said Wasim al-Sarraj, a Gaza-based researcher. Wasim goes on to say, quote, since that point, we have had intense drone activity and bombing that has been sustained. I am at home with two young children, and this is very worrying to all of us. We are expecting the worst over the next couple of days. That's his quote. Another quote from Bhutti, who is from the former advisor to the PLO, Diana Bhutti. She says, quote, Israel's latest bombing campaign in Gaza, and in particular its assassination of Palestinian leaders, highlights once again that Israel views itself as above the law. This is precisely why the international community, and in particular the United States, must hold Israel accountable for its provocative and illegal action in order to stop another bloodbath in Gaza before it happens. It is time for the world to send Israel the message that it is not above the law and the Palestinians are not beneath it. Well, I'm delighted to have as my guest today Mr. Grant Smith. We are going to discuss whether or not Israel is above the law. Grant Smith has made a thorough investigation of the question, of this question, in his book, Divert. Mr. Smith is the director of the Washington, D.C.-based Institute for Research Middle East Policy. The Institute is an independent nonprofit that studies U.S. policy formation towards the Middle East. Smith's research and analysis about trade, law enforcement, and opportunity costs have appeared in antiwar.com, the Financial Times of London, Inc. magazine, Arab News, Kiplinger, Gannett, The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post, The Jewish Daily Forward. I mean, I could go on and on. Grant Smith has also appeared on the BBC, C-SPAN, Al Jazeera, CNN, Press TV. In 2003, Mr. Smith launched the Institute at a policy symposium in the Rayburn House Office Building on Capitol Hill, warning about the grave dangers of adopting a 1996 neoconservative plan for involving the U.S. military more deeply across the Middle East. So, Grant, thank you for joining me this afternoon.
Well, thank you so much for having me on today, Kathleen. It's a real honor to be on your show.
And I mean, and the timing is perfect because, as I mentioned in my intro, Gaza is currently under airstrike, under attack.
Yeah, and I'd just like to echo the fact that you're spot on with your analysis about the Tawdry Petraeus affair, which is dominating media bandwidth, when, in fact, the attack has been announced and foreshadowed by the Israeli diplomatic corps for days now as they seek to change the subject on what will be the Palestinian Authority's bid at the United Nations to have recognition of status there and the right to go before the UN General Assembly for a vote to give them greater status at the United Nations. So I totally agree with your assessment.
So we, you know, we hear consistently that Israel is an ally and is an ally to the United States. And after reading your book, probably I didn't need to read your book, but your book even drove it home, this idea, it drove it home even more. If Israel is an ally, what is that expression? I don't need any enemy. Do you know the expression?
Well, the book is taking a saga, the saga of Dr. Zalman Shapiro and the Nuclear Materials and Equipment Corporation from back in the 50s and 60s, and putting together all of the details in one place to really reveal, I think, conclusively what you've just stated, that what CIA officials and the Directorate of Operations and Tel Aviv outposts have said about the diversion of weapons-grade uranium from the United States, the unauthorized diversion, the illegal diversion, in coordination with various spying organizations and at the periphery of established U.S. lobbying in what are what claim to be charitable organizations is a fact. It's not a conspiracy theory. Anybody who's come at the full corpus of documents, which dates from 1956 to the present, see a growing pile of evidence that material that was supplied in good faith by the U.S. government to a nuclear processing facility in Apollo, Pennsylvania, an environment now that has a little over 4,000 population, was in fact a portion of it, 337 kilograms, was diverted into Israel's secret nuclear weapons program in the 1960s and used to assemble some of the first weapons, which Henry Kissinger confidentially noted in some national security files, were to be used on various types of intermediate-range missiles to change the balance of power between Israel and basically the world forever thereafter. And the conclusion from the documents that have been released or leaked is definitively that this was not the desire of the United States to have this small country in such a volatile region go nuclear.
Mm-hmm.
And I applaud you for exploring it, even though the details are tedious, because this is a factor that's absolutely critical to understanding this current overhyped standoff with Iran over its civilian nuclear program that's never mentioned in our large established media organizations. They do not touch this subject at all.
Well, I mean, I didn't find the details tedious at all. In fact, I found it rather very intriguing, and your book is thoroughly documented with supporting, or the position is clearly documented and supported with declassified documents. You have extensive footnotes. It's incontrovertible what has taken place.
Right, and that was the desire, because a lot of these documents have been floating around for some time, and others have only recently been released, such as a GAO study that we got our hands on in 2010, which definitively said that there was inadequate criminal investigation of this affair. But it's never been pulled into one place, and this has been mentioned in passing by journalists such as Seymour Hersh and in passing by other journalists who have tried to look at this context, but it's never been given book-length treatment. And I'm thoroughly convinced that if you're going to have the United States go toward red lines on what are faulty and misguided myths about the Iranian nuclear program, it's long past time to deal with the U.S.'s own role in being essentially dragged out of compliance with the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty,
mm-hmm.
which obligates countries like the United States not to allow their technology, know-how, and most importantly, nuclear material leak out to other states or groups. And so we're pushing and have been pushing to make this documentary body available on the Internet, and it is. If you look up NUMEC, you can find it easily.
Mm-hmm.
Put it out to the UN, get it in front of the treaty organizations that will be gathering in Helsinki so that they can have a more informed discussion about what it means to move toward a nuclear-free Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hoping that I would still say the book itself is a hard slog for your average person because it is incredibly detailed. But I'm hoping we're going to be able to change the debate with this information.
Oh, I hope we can change the debate because it has the whole issue has consequences for Americans and for Iran and for the whole world over. One of the things that you mentioned was that you said that America did not want Israel to become a nuclear power. And yet,
right.
All presidents have essentially sort of cast or characterize Israel's nuclear position as ambiguous.
Right. This is a question, and it's something that, you know, just imagine if this question had been a third presidential debate, and the moderator, you know, while they were talking about foreign policy, had asked them what Helen Thomas asked the president back before she was pushed out. The simple question of, do you know of any states in the Middle East that's currently a nuclear weapons state? The sad fact of the matter is that U.S. presidents, with the single exception of Jimmy Carter, who after he left office admitted that Israel had some 150-plus nuclear weapons, U.S. presidents have been bound by a horrible pact, which more than anything causes problems for the United States as opposed to any other country, a horrible pact called strategic ambiguity, in which both the United States and Israel neither confirm nor deny that the Israelis have a massive stockpile of nuclear weapons. And this pact was made between Nixon and Golda Meir, with Henry Kissinger fluttering around at the edges. And it was a way of being able to escape the hard questions that were being asked by Congress and independent journalists at the time about the diversion of materials and large groups of American nuclear scientists taking vacations in Israel during the time of its nuclear weapons development period in the 1960s. And so you're right that presidents have generally acquiesced to this hoary old policy of strategic ambiguity, while the establishment media has generally let them off the hook, and most establishment reporters will not put presidents on the spot over this question. And it's my theory, and the research in the book indicates this, that because the United States fought this until the death of Kennedy, fought it vigorously, and because so many illegal acts were surrounding the diversion of materials and know-how, that it was easier for the United States to continue to promote nuclear non-proliferation while ignoring the Israeli theft, because it really would have had to have taken some action and faced consequences politically, domestically, if it had called Israel out and begun withholding weapons. Nixon and Kissinger anguished in documents that were recently released about if they started withholding jet fighters and Congress was starting to agitate and be whipped up by the Israelis over that sort of thing, they wouldn't have been able to explain that they were doing it over the nuclear question. And that's kind of the predicament the U.S. has been in ever since.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, we call it diversion. That's a sort of, that's a fancy word. It's not, you know, it's a nice word because it's really theft, isn't it?
Well, it is theft, and, you know, the book is called Divert because that was the code name of the second FBI investigation, which finally really netted some eyewitness testimony of the actual tactical on-the-ground diversion. But, it was definitely a theft because the material that went overseas was material that was supposed to have been processed into nuclear submarine fuel, which was delivered to this small, undercapitalized startup company that was unfortunately located in an abandoned steel mill in the middle of a quaint village, to be processed into Navy fuel. And instead, according to eyewitness accounts, a large quantity of it was taken and sealed into irradiation and weather equipment and rushed to the piers of New York for shipment to Israel. And so, although that eyewitness FBI testimony existed and they finally started really putting this together during the second FBI investigation, codenamed Divert, it was nearing the end of the Carter administration. And as far as we can tell, the death of the investigation occurred at the end of the Carter administration because the Reagan administration refused to take it on and seriously pursue it.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. You say the Reagan administration refused to pursue it. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about that it didn't just start with this diversion program in the 60s, that Israel has actually been engaged in a smuggling of military materials from the United States since right after World War II. That's the Haganah smuggling network, correct? So we're going to talk about that, and then we're going to talk about why presidents have sort of covered up or remained hush-hush about it. We're going to take a break. The call-in number, call in if you have questions. I'll open up the phone lines at the break, after the break, on the other side of the break, and that number is 1-888-909-1050. So if you have questions for Grant, please feel free to call in, and we're going to come right back. So I'll meet you on the other side. Thanks.
Conscience International is an organization specializing in the delivery of medical aid to refugee victims of war and natural disasters. Since 1982, Conscience International has assisted refugees in the Middle East, Africa, the Caribbean, and Asia. The organization is led by Dr. James Jennings, whose life-saving efforts have been acknowledged by humanitarian awards from around the world. For more information and to make a tax-deductible donation to this worthy cause, please visit the Conscience International website at conscienceinternational.org.
Logos is an online quarterly journal of modern culture, politics, and society featuring cutting-edge articles on politics, culture, the arts, as well as book reviews and original, often experimental, fiction and poetry. Logos fosters critical dialogue on modern society and current affairs by giving readers insight into the events that shape their lives. Logos, critical ideas for the engaged reader. Read online for free at www.logosjournal.com. For information about submissions to the journal, please contact Logos Online at igc.org.
Playgrounds for Palestine is a non-for-profit 501c3 organization dedicated to upholding the Palestinian child's rights to play. This is a right enshrined in the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child. We operate through a volunteer board and staff, the generosity of our supporters, and a lot of heart. To date, Playgrounds for Palestine has constructed 15 playgrounds in Palestine, as well as refugee camps in Lebanon and Syria. To contribute to this most worthy cause, please go to our website at www.playgroundsforpalestine.org. Or send a check to Playgrounds for Palestine, P.O. Box 559, Yardley, Pennsylvania, 19067. At www.playgroundsforpalestine.org.
Real talk for real people, right here in the Inland Empire. We are 1050 AM, KCAA.
Let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
Okay, let's see. We have learned reading your book that, you know, this incident that took place, or this saga that took place in the 60s, isn't the first time that this smuggling has taken place in the United States. In fact, right after World War II, there was smuggling going on with the Haganah smuggling network.
Absolutely.
Can you touch on that?
Yeah, that's a key component to the story. The National Archives and Records Administration at College Park, Maryland, has a 4,000-page file about an archipelago of smuggling companies from Martec to Service Airways, Materials for Palestine, and Foundry Associates, which were all discovered by the FBI and Justice Department to be coordinating with the government in waiting in Israel to begin siphoning up as many surplus World War II supplies as they could get their hands on and ship them to Jewish fighters in Palestine. And what we see in that 4,000-page archive, which, as far as I can tell, only two people have ever looked at, Stephen Green, who wrote a book back in 84, and myself,
uh-huh.
is the massive circumvention of the Arms Export Control Act, the Neutrality Act, as everything from B-17 bombers to tanks routed through Latin American straw buyers to 50-caliber machine guns stolen from Marine bases in Hawaii to Lockheed Constellation transport aircraft were all purchased from the War Assets Administration or stolen, including Remington ammunition manufacturing equipment, and illegally shipped overseas by means of false packaging. In fact, Foundry Associates had a gigantic quantity of explosives they bought through a mining front company packed into packages with innocent labels spill onto New York piers, almost killing workers who had no idea that it was what was being done. And that touched off the FBI investigation that gradually found the entire network, or a lot of the network, and identified both high-ranking and low-ranking people who had tangential relationships with what are today considered to be legitimate Israel lobbying organizations. But the sad part of the story, and what is the lesson for today, is the Israeli ambassador was able to corral people such as Abraham Feinberg, who was Truman's key campaign bundler and also served as LBJ's key campaign contribution bundler, to actually quash active investigations before they got to the indictment stage or the criminal complaint stage. And so you have internal FBI reports complaining about this gross interference in U.S. domestic due process in the legal system, as just about every single smuggler was let off. A few of them had felony convictions and fines, which were later overturned by presidential pardons. One, Charles Winters, actually did some prison time. He was pardoned by George W. Bush after heavy lobbying by Steven Spielberg and others back at the end of the Bush administration. So you had, before the nuclear smuggling, you had massive conventional smuggling that broke interstate arms trafficking laws, broke Neutrality Act, Arms Export Control Act, totally thwarted U.S. policy in terms of Middle East policy. And it was even detected by the OSS and CIA as some of the air crews and other Jewish Americans going to fight in Palestine were detected lying to European air controllers as they skirted through war-torn Europe and made their way with their weapons into Palestine.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking about decades. Starting back in the 40s.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's never really stopped. I mean, you know, in this country, if you mention the name A.Q. Khan, that will drum up ideas of a Pakistani involved in shipping nuclear weapons technology all over the country. And the U.S. squawked long and hard about the exports of various equipment used to actually manufacture and measure detonations. Yet even in 2010, an Israeli front company was caught in California, a company called Telegy International, which was also shipping export control technology, except not to Pakistan, to Israel. And essentially nothing was done. It didn't even trigger an FBI investigation.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's been ongoing since the 1940s.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is an important aspect of it, that nothing gets done. In fact, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been linked to nuclear technology smuggling ring, correct?
Well, that's that's a story that's still waiting to break in the mainstream media, and perhaps we'll be waiting a while more. But that's something that came out of declassified FBI files. There was a case in the mid-1970s that extended into the 1980s where Krytrons, which are used as nuclear weapons triggers, dual-use technology, were being smuggled through a network of front companies to the Israeli Ministry of Defense. This year, the FBI released some transcripts of an interview they conducted with the U.S. Node of that smuggling network, Richard Kelly Smythe, who actually sat down in 2002 and told the Justice Department that the Israeli end of the smuggling network, a guy working at a company called Helai Trading Company in Israel, was none other than Benjamin Netanyahu, who he would meet with and coordinate the transfer of these prohibited export control technologies from the U.S. Now, that story went out. We've put the FBI documents online, and they've, of course, generated a lot of attention in the international press, but the U.S. press, including the New York Times, Democracy Now!, anyone you can imagine along the spectrum of news and analysis has utterly ignored these revelations. It doesn't fit the narrative that they've been pushing all year.
Mm-hmm. So let's look at the cover-up. That's something that we've touched on, the fact that no sitting president has actually been able to, no sitting president has ever revealed the, You're right.
Okay.
No sitting president will probably ever reveal how the influence of the Israel lobby has so corrupted U.S. government that even sitting presidents cannot protect the most powerful technologies unlocked by American science from immediate proliferation by Israel. So in other words,
right.
Do anything.
No, really can't do anything. And you see this in the Nixon-Kissinger discussions where, as you might imagine, after he was finally forced out of NUMEC, Zalman Shapiro, who was actually a nuclear fuel specialist, worked his network and managed to land a job at Berilco, which was working on the most advanced U.S. hydrogen bomb designs. And so he was going to finagle his way into access to the most sophisticated H-bomb designs that the U.S. had been able to put together by the early 1970s, and this set off alarm bells in the Atomic Energy Commission, the FBI, the CIA, the White House, and they got together, and for an entire year, rather than figure out how to take some of the information about his demonstrated contacts with Israeli intelligence operatives, including Rafael Eitan, who ran Jonathan Pollard 20 years later, they figured out that they had to get him a better job and that they had to be careful because he was so interconnected through his Zionist Organization of America and other affiliations to elite figures across science and industry, that their problem wasn't prosecuting him for, you know, shipping out material and know-how to his Israeli friends who he'd visit on a frequent basis. It was getting him into a position where he might not have access to the very latest designs. And, you know, miraculously, they were able to get him a job at Westinghouse as opposed to raising his security clearances and letting him go hog wild in the vault of the most sophisticated H-bomb designs.
But, see, I can't understand why these guys aren't prosecuted for their criminal activity.
As a legal expert, I'm not talking about myself. The transcripts at the Justice Department and from the FBI agents who want to write criminal information is they never managed to get to that stage, and a number of figures. Including Norman Dacey, who for a long time worked with Rabbi Elmer Berger on Palestinian rights issue would contact the Justice Department and say, look, you know, you have all this information. You've been notified up and down. We know for 20 years that you've had more than enough information to indict some of the people active in these, including large groups of lawyers.
Uh-huh.
And yet you do nothing. And the Justice Department and State Department will talk about the statute of limitations. They'll talk about that they didn't have knowledge. They won't discuss, you know, declassified files. They just won't act because the pressures, as any appointee knows, will fall upon getting them out of their job and switching in somebody more compliant should they ever actually try to take action on this. This is not like going after some disconnected, small-time drug dealer or even a mafia figure.
It's not like going after – I mean, listen, our prisons are full, right?
Sure.
So it's not like going after somebody with crack cocaine, right? No.
No, and not even a network. I mean, you can definitely go after major drug traffickers much easier than you can go after some of these operators. And, you know,
we've seen that with
case after case.
You can't get someone who's committed treason or espionage. It's not, because they're what? Too well connected.
Too well connected, and the organizations from which many of these people serve, including the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, which countless times has been caught handling national defense information to the detriment of the U.S., they will commit millions and millions of dollars to the defense and unraveling through, at times, means that border on obstruction of justice to get their people sprung.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, the horrifying thing today is that former Congresswoman Jane Harman,
uh-huh,
who was implicated in trying to spring Keith Rosman and Steve Rosen and Keith Weissman from, you know, having taken classified information to try and drum up a war with Iran, is being considered seriously by serious thinkers as a possible replacement to CIA Director Petraeus, which, to anybody who's actually concerned about the future of this country, is a horrifying thought to have.
Yes, it's a horrifying thought. But you say that possibly Shapiro will, you know, that his criminal negligence will maybe come to light because the fact we have to clean up his mess, literally, the American...
Yeah, literally. Exactly. You're right. There's a cleanup going on by the Army Corps of Engineers of Parks Township, and this is moving back to the NUMEC case. Parks Township, a giant dump that was created there, which suffered all sorts of spills just due to undercapitalization and outright negligence. And so what's happening is there's a lot of attention on the fact that U.S. taxpayers are going to be stuck with what could be a $500 million bill cleaning up after NUMEC's mess. And so currently there are a number of civil lawsuits trying to recover damage for health and property value declines that were triggered by NUMEC's negligence. But unfortunately, they're being against companies that didn't come into the picture until 1967, after Shapiro had been diverting uranium for 10 years. But on the plus side, there are new institutions, the Obama administration's Freedom of Information Act commitments and commitment to opening government and not allowing perpetual secrecy on matters, has allowed activists on the NUMEC case to appeal to a new panel called the ICECAP panel, which can overrule the CIA in particular and the National Security Agency and the National Archives Presidential Libraries, which like to hang on to stuff forever, and make them declassify and publicly release some of their most sensitive documents. And so a large number of NUMEC documents have already been put on the docket for review over the next year, and what we expect is to be able to get enough information so that some of those civil suits can be redirected toward the Israeli government and the founders of NUMEC and away from sort of these straw targets that have been suffering the brunt of the lawsuits.
Well, I mean, would the statute of limitations have run on these causes of action?
No, not necessarily, because the civil suits are for ongoing damages to health and to the values of the property. And so a creative lawyer, and believe me, more than a few are looking at this right now, are looking at how to sort of reformat some of these suits that have been misdirected against companies that didn't commit any crimes in the area, and leverage some of the declassified information to actually zero in on some of the true perpetrators.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, this smuggling, this illegal activity, this treason, this espionage has been instrumental, but for it, we wouldn't see what's going on today in to the Gazians, to the Palestinians. Can you make that argument?
I think you can. The fact that the U.S. wasn't able to control conventional arms smuggling, that it had groups that were able to sort of supersede or ignore U.S. Middle East policy and overrule, you know, the direct desires of the president as executed through the State Department, all of that had an effect of altering the balance of power. And although the Israelis probably would have acquired nuclear weapons just purely based on their work with the French and some other techniques they had for acquiring materials and processing it, the United States wouldn't have been to blame for that and therefore wouldn't have had to abide by this ridiculous thing called strategic ambiguity. So I think it has had an ongoing negative effect, and I think you can make the argument that the U.S. and the region wouldn't be in such bad shape if we didn't have, as sort of the undercurrent to our regional policy, this inability to have sovereign policies and actually be able to control the activities of these parastatal groups.
Mm-hmm. Well, you make the suggestion in the book, but you're not directly, you don't explicitly state it. Do you think that there has been collaboration inside the U.S. government regarding the diversion of nuclear material to Israel?
Well, what's happened in some of the offhand statements of people closest to the NUMEC case is that they will suggest to FBI investigators that somehow all of this was just above their pay grade and give the impression that whatever action they took, they were bulletproof because they somehow had achieved some higher-up authority. But the CIA Directorate of Operations, Carl Duckett, made it clear that he had never heard of any CIA clandestine operation to arm the Israelis with nuclear weapons. And Tel Aviv Station Chief John Haddon also never found any evidence that there was a directive from a sitting U.S. president to help them arm. And you can also see in previous CIA documents that they believed it would be a net negative and that the Israelis would never negotiate peace with their neighbors if they did finally achieve nuclear weapons. So, you know, there are still archives in the JFK and LBJ National Archive presidential collections that haven't been cracked open. But to date, there is no indication of collaboration. Kissinger, you know, basically calls it, you know, they might have even stolen from us when he first hears of this. He doesn't say, you know, in private in his classified memos, the plan is, you know, working just, you know, perfectly and swimmingly. So I don't believe that there was any collaboration, but
I'm thinking of Seaborg, who worked at the agency. You know, he was always
Seaborg,
sort of defending Shapiro.
Yeah, he was the commissioner of the Atomic Energy Commission. He was extremely concerned because he had seen what he considered the persecution of some of the leading scientists in the Manhattan Project, discredited and pursued as communists. So he was concerned that his entire cadre of top brains in the Manhattan Project, who later went into the civilian nuclear civilian nuclear industry, were going to be, you know, an open revolt as there were continual crackdowns over national security, because many of his close collaborators Robert Oppenheimer in particular, were very, you know, very vocal and prominent figures. And so, you know, he had a lot of weaknesses in terms of not wanting to rock the boat and really have a robust civilian nuclear industry. So, you know, I think his concerns about that were clouding his eyes to the extent that even when two Department of Energy agency officials came in and told him that they picked up traces of U-235 that had been supplied to NUMEC in Israel, he just couldn't believe it and he couldn't deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't see him as much of a collaborator as kind of a dupe, who, by the way, was being courted by people like Abraham Feinberg, who was named in 1956 by none other than David Ben-Gurion to be the key nuclear weapons fundraising coordinator in the United States. And this is according to Avner Cohen, who has reviewed the papers. He's the author of Israel and the Bomb and has done some excellent research into this. So you had Seaborg and various presidents surrounded by people who were up to their elbows in making sure that Israel was armed to the teeth with nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you now, Grant, how would you characterize this debate regarding Iran being in the market, or how do I want to put this, Iran being a threat to stability in the region because of their desire to acquire the bomb?
I think it's every bit as convincing as the rationale given for the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Or to say
mm-hmm.
it another way, it's pure baloney. I mean, you know, the reasons that the Israelis are extremely anxious to continue agitating against Iran have very little to do with Iran's civilian nuclear program, and a lot more to do with diverting attention from the increasing rate of illegal settlements and changing the subject on having any sort of a peace process. And it's worked extremely well for the Israelis. In terms of the United States, you know, it hasn't worked out that well. It would be much better for the United States to have productive relations, or as Zbigniew Brzezinski said, you know, begin working with Iran in order to have a better influence in that part of Asia. It's the key to unlocking more productive economic relations with the entire region. But instead, we're saddled with this false crisis that has continually been whipped up in the press and affected domestic politics and really stifled the bandwidth of U.S. diplomacy in the region. I mean, we can barely do anything because of this false crisis that's been, you know, brewing now and building and building and building over the last decade.
Mm-hmm. So the media is the fourth estate. So why don't we have more journalists, reporters like yourself, investigative journalists, doing this work, being thorough and researching and asking the right questions? Why don't we see more of that?
Well, since the 1960s, organizations with close ties to Israel, like CAMRA and the American Israel Public Affairs Committee and the ADL, have all been very, very proactive in getting journalists who do this type of work fired. And so the only way to actually do this without having a boycott against advertisers or, you know, being smeared in the press is to do it independently. One of the benefits of kind of the collapse of establishment newspapers and the rise of blogs and alternative media is that journalists are freed up to explore these areas and look at the primary research online. It just couldn't be done when you had four channels and, you know, two establishment East Coast newspapers that were facing a lot of pressure not to rock the boat. But fortunately, they don't matter as much anymore. It's safe to say that the documents linking Benjamin Netanyahu to Crytron theft from the United States are fairly widely circulated at this point, and all the people who would have an interest in obtaining them and studying them for examination at nuclear conferences already have access to that. The report, the GAO report, declassified in 2010, about the U.S. failure to investigate, has been downloaded hundreds of thousands of times. And so, fortunately, the question that you ask, you know, what about the mainstream pampered journalists in this country, they're becoming increasingly irrelevant. They've been put in a bad spot over the last 30 years, that's for sure. You know, fortunately, there's a replacement for them.
Mm-hmm. I mean, look, listen, they're not even covering, instead of covering, you know, smuggling of our threats to our national security by the diversion of nuclear material to Israel, or instead of covering the Israeli strikes that are going on right now in Gaza, we're talking about what? Crap.
Right. Well, you know, but on the other hand, great California outlet, antiwar.com, is talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
Democracy Now! Is picking up on parts of it. Mondo Weiss is picking up on it. I mean, if people want the information, if they want to be responsible news consumers and take the energy to go get it, they can get it. They can get eyewitness accounts, as you've just put out there,
yeah,
from people on the ground right now, talking about the target selection of this targeted assassination campaign. So to the extent that people want to break out of, you know, the matrix and take the red pill, they can do that. They can actually get off kind of the propaganda bubble and get into, you know, start swimming the information sea. It's out there.
Oh, I like that. We want to take the red pill because we want to get out of the matrix.
Well, it feels like that sometimes, doesn't it?
I like that. You're absolutely right. Well, I'm so delighted to have you on my show. I'm going to have you on again because you have another book, and that book, and I haven't read it yet. I read Divert, and I recommend it highly to my listeners because it's so, I mean, it's not tedious to me because I'm used to reading legal documents, but it is definitely intriguing in the sense that, you know, it could be made into a movie. It's like, it's a true story about spying. Do you think that's an apt characterization?
Yeah, I do, and it more than that, it's true, timely, and it can actually help people, you know, begin to take required action to do something about it. So I really appreciate being on your show to talk about it.
Okay, and let me just mention your other book, that's Divert, is the book I've read. I'm going to have you on again to talk about spy trade, which is, how Israel's lobby undermines America's economy. I'm going to have you on again to discuss that book. I haven't read it yet, but after I read it, you're going to come on, okay, Grant?
Beautiful, beautiful. Thank you. Take care.
Grant, thank you very much. Okay, thank
Appreciate
you, KCAA listeners. I love having Grant Smith on because he makes us take the red pill and get out of the matrix. This is so fantastic. So next week, we're going to have another good show, and so join us next week. Thanks again. KCAA listeners, this is the Kathleen Wells Show, and I'm Kathleen, and I'll see you next week. Thanks. Imagine there's no country.